Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Tim Stenovek and Ed Ludlow live from New York City and California. Well, Elon Musk wants to mine it. China is scouring Tibet for it. Battery makers are crying out for it. It's lithium, the wonder metal at the heart of the global shift to electric cars, and it's in a full-blown crisis. Demand has outstripped supply, pushing prices up almost 500% in a year and hindering the world's most successful effort yet to halt global warming. We're very pleased to have with us Jack Lifton. He's a physical and chemical engineer and an advisor to One World Lithium. It's a mineral exploration and development company. Jack, great to have you with us. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate you taking the time. Give us an idea on where you think lithium prices are going to go in this environment.
I don't see lithium prices coming down, even though major money center banks think they will, because demand is outstripping supply dramatically, and which is the reason that prices are so high. And I don't see that changing. And I also do not see a great deal of new production coming online. The production coming online in the next few years has already been accounted for in the pricing. So the truth is that there's not much we can do about increasing supply. And demand is increasing, therefore price is going to either go up or stay up.
Jack, it's Ed in San Francisco. Good afternoon to you. We're led to believe there's this mad scramble then across OEMs and other tier one suppliers about EV supply, right? So if that supply is not going to increase, what are the conversations you're having? What can be done for these automakers that basically want to ensure they do have the supply for when that demand curve hits a later stage?
Well, here's the issue. In the long run, only the most efficient, lowest cost suppliers of anything survive in the marketplace. That's also true of lithium. Now, the problem with producing lithium in quantity is that there are only two sources of lithium, the so-called salars, the brine deposits, which are all through the Americas, or the hard rock deposits, which are most common in Australia. So in the Americas, we have to produce lithium from brine. To produce lithium from the day you start the process to the day you finish a batch can take up to 2 years. Hmm. Because what you're doing is drying out an immense volume of liquid to precipitate the solids and then extract from them the lithium. The richest brine in the world that can be commercial, the brines are in either Chile or Bolivia, and they are 3,000 to 5,000 parts per million of lithium. Now, if I want 5,000 tons of lithium from a brine that contains 5,000 parts per million, I have to dry 1 million tons of brine. Now, I can't do that on the stove with the kettle, so. These are done by solar evaporation. You let the stuff dry out in the sun. It's time consuming, and that makes it very expensive.
Hey, Jack. So, Jack, we don't have a ton of time with you, so I want to make sure to get to this. What would you say to someone who says the type of technology is changing so quickly here that there are already companies looking for ways to develop batteries without using these natural resources? So perhaps in maybe a dozen years or so, we won't have to rely on lithium to the same extent that we are today to build batteries for EVs.
You know that storage batteries have been constantly developed for about 170 years. Anyone who thinks that, oh, gee, we're going to have something new right away is being nonsensical. And the study of chemistry, electrochemistry, has been in progress for about a century. We know the properties and characteristics of the chemical elements. Quite frankly, the best battery, the best type of battery for storage, for either grid smoothing or transportation, is the lithium-ion battery. There are going to be no replacements that can give you this kind of storage level and relative inexpensiveness. So I'm sorry, I don't go along with that reasoning. The idea that disruptive or innovative technologies are just going to take over is contrary to history.
All right, Jack, let's go back to basics then. If I'm an EV maker, whether American or European, why don't I just buy a source of lithium direct, own the miner? And what kind of conversations are you having with EV makers about that tactic?
In my opinion, the EV makers are in a panic worldwide. I'll give you an example. Ford and General Motors each say they'll be producing 2 million battery-powered EVs by the year 2026. That would mean they would need each 100,000 tons of lithium carbonate to make the batteries for those 2 million cars. That would be, together, one-third of all the lithium produced in this last year. That's not a very likely outcome. So there's more lithium on the way. The problem is, like I said, it takes a long time to produce lithium and a long time to develop a mine. The key is technological improvement in recovering lithium from lower and lower grade sources. There's a lot of low grade sources in the world.
So, Jack, who's going to pay for that then? Who's going to pay for that if it requires investment in new technology? Is it the end user, the EV makers, or is it the mining industry itself?
You're going to pay for it.
Well, hold on a minute.
Tesla just raised the price of the S, I believe, or the Y, by $6,000. General Motors just yesterday announced the increase of the Hummer EV, $6,000. That's coming from lithium cost problems. The battery is now the most expensive component in the car. It always was in an electric car, but it costs far more than an internal combustion engine to manufacture because of the cost of raw materials. And car companies can't keep this up forever. Once the average price to save an electric car in the U.S. is almost $60,000. This used to be called a luxury car. Now it's an average electric car. Unless you're willing to pay for it, you're not going to get one.
So, Jack, just in the last minute that we have with you, give us an idea of where lithium prices go. Do we see some sort of reprieve here after this run-up?
I think what's going to happen is that this run-up is going to promote more efficient production of lithium with, for example, direct lithium extraction technology now being pushed into development. The costs have to go down or there isn't going to be an EV revolution. The cars are getting too expensive.
All right. Jack Lifton, advisor in physical and chemical engineer at One World Lithium, joining us on the phone from Detroit. Jack, thanks so much for taking the time.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we got a check on oil and gas stocks from Charlie just now. Also a check of oil prices, which are lower today. This after President Joe Biden called on Congress to suspend the federal gasoline tax. This a largely symbolic move by an embattled president running out of options to ease pump prices weighing on his party's political prospects. We should note that oil prices have been down throughout the day over concerns of a possible recession and global slowdown. We've got a great voice on this. Julia Fenzeres is oil markets reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from New York City. Julia, good to have you with us. I want to start with the Biden news about a gas tax. Break this down for us. As I mentioned, our own Josh Wingrove and Jenny Leonard writing that it is largely symbolic. Do you see it any other way?
No, I think everyone is seeing it as largely symbolic. And earlier, we were also reporting that it's quite possible that this could have an adverse effect on gasoline prices, that if you take away this tax, so it obviously helped a little bit in the short term, but when gas prices come back to normal and you put that tax back, they might actually spike higher than they did before. That's what happened in some states, including Maryland. So it really could be detrimental.
Right. And in those states, they also had loss of tax revenues, which had some, you know, material impact to them. I'm fascinated by the oil market right now. You know, you turn your attention away for a moment and the story changes. We've moved from supply disruption, focus on the war in Ukraine, to recession fears. Right, Julia? So talk me through that balance right now. How is oil supply? What is the narrative around oil supply? And why is the market lower than in recent days?
You are absolutely correct. Right now, the market has been driven on fear. You saw that we lost as much as $7 overnight because of varied things. First, obviously, we have been talking about a potential recession and what that would mean for demand, that might mean that demand would be lowered and therefore there would be less crude needed on the market. But also, we see that there has been lower liquidity for Brent and WTI open interest are now falling down to six-year lows. And that's going to exacerbate any move that happens in the market. That's why oil really dropped those $7 overnight, because there's not enough liquidity in the market to keep it bolstered. So while the fundamentals are there, while we are still in a tight market, obviously it's still driving season, it's still summer, that lowered liquidity is really going to exacerbate these big moves that we see.
And Julia, what happens when we start to see an increase in economic activity as COVID lockdowns ease, particularly in China? Will we see prices rise then? What are analysts telling you?
That's exactly it. China still hasn't been able to come back, but if China comes back, that's going to tighten the markets even more. You're going to see even less crude in the market. You're going to see, because obviously China is one of the biggest consumers. And so when China comes out of all of these lockdowns, that's going to tighten the situation even more. And we could see higher prices, but analysts are still saying that if a recession comes in, that could really still impact prices. And we may have still seen the highest prices when Russia invaded the Ukraine in late February, those highs of around $120 a barrel. We may not see those highs just yet, especially as we're exiting the summer season and the high consumption season.
Judy, I'm going to recap some of the lines from President Biden on oil. He called on the industry to refine more oil. He also gave shout out and praise to OPEC Plus and their commitment to increase supply. And Tim was talking about how, you know, a gas tax holiday, largely symbolic. There's a lot of discussion around how OPEC Plus and oil producing nations' commitment to produce more oil is also largely symbolic. And in practice, it doesn't result in more oil. Can you talk us through that one?
Absolutely. It is absolutely largely symbolic, especially because OPEC Plus, the cartel, yes, they decided to increase production quota, but what they did was they increased evenly amongst all countries in the production group. And what does that mean? That means that the countries who were not even able to make their quotas in the first place will have to have even higher quotas. So it's not like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which have the highest production capacity and spare capacity, they are not the ones taking on this extra capacity. It was evenly distributed. So it doesn't really look like there's going to be that much crude added to the markets by OPEC Plus. And obviously, it is political and largely symbolic that Biden tipped his head to OPEC because they did increase it slightly, but that's still not enough crude to add what needs to be added into this very tight market where people are coming back. They have that want to be able to drive. They want that be able to travel. They're not seeing that, and you're not going to be able to do that if there's not enough crude.
Hey, Julia, bring us into the politics of this. We saw back and forth between President Biden and executives at oil companies over the last couple of days. And I'm wondering if you could give us an idea about what oil executives are thinking with regard to the government right now. Because on the one hand, you have the president calling to lower prices. But on the other hand, you have companies that don't necessarily have the refining capacity or don't necessarily have the will to start production of new wells or get equipment going to drill more at this point because they're potentially concerned about the long-term effect of this.
Absolutely. And I think these companies are very upset because Biden was also threatening windfall tax profits. And so he's saying, please, you have to drill more. And if you don't drill more, we're going to take some of your profits. So I think that the producers are not very much inclined to give the Biden administration additional help to drill more, especially because they don't know how long these high profits are going to last, and it also takes a while to get into drilling. It's not an immediate decision. Mm-hmm. It takes weeks to be able to, one, open a new refinery, or months to be able to do that and to start drilling again. So they have really been able to hold back even with these higher prices, and I don't think that they are at all inclined by the administration to help them out right now.
Julia, my old mate Julian Lee in London writing on the Bloomberg Terminal that Russian oil disappears as tankers go dark near the Azores. Julian and I used to chase around Vienna in OPEC meetings, fond memories of him. But just very quickly, sum up the situation of the war in Ukraine, Russian oil supply, and how that is impacting the market.
I mean, it is still impacting the market very much so, because you have all of these Russian barrels. What is it? Maybe 13 million barrels a day that you do not have anymore in this market. You don't have Russian products. That's also the big thing. It's not just crude, which obviously Biden has been tapping into SPRs and trying to get OPEC to get more crude, but it's these refined products that we are really in loss of in the market right now. You don't have diesel. You don't have gasoline. And that shortage, especially because we as the U.S. and also now all of these other nations in Europe as well, they have banned Russian oil and refined products. That has really continued to exacerbate the tight market. The market was tight going into before Russia invaded the Ukraine, and now it's even tighter.
Julia Fanzaris, oil markets reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone from New York City. Julia, we love talking oil with you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher-level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Okay, Ed Ludlow, you're still relishing in the win from your beloved Golden State Warriors, right?
I am, and it was a fantastic day on Monday, a parade for the ages. The sun was shining, the blue and gold. It was glittering on the streets of San Francisco.
I do love
that one out of the way.
I just love the way that you are so passionate about basketball. It just brings cheer to me. But look, tomorrow is the buzziest day of the year when it comes to professional basketball, because tomorrow is the draft. A former NCAA player, though, hasn't won an MVP award since 2018. These days, the NBA is turning not to China, not to the United States, not to American colleges and universities, but to Africa to fuel basketball's next era of growth. Kim Bassine writes all about it in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine. You can read it now on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com. Kim is a reporter for Bloomberg News. He's with me now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Also joining us is Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Joel, I want to start with you. Why Africa for the next stage of growth for the NBA?
Well, NBA has a great tradition of looking abroad for talent, and you see this not only with recent MVPs, but reflections in the draft, which, reminder, that happens tomorrow. So that we're not going to see this reflected in this year's draft, but a while ago, the NBA put a huge sort of priority on China and developing and cultivating talent there. That culminated with Yao, and sort of created this moment where basketball got big there. But that's gotten a little rocky, which we can talk about. But right now, the NBA sees Africa as its future. There's a new league that the NBA has helped set up there. This is a talent pipeline that we're going to see. There's already kind of a storied history there, but the relationship and the sort of that pipeline wasn't quite as developed as I think it's about to become. And what Kim found here was that the NBA is all in on this. They like what it looks like. It's already has a version of success, and it's only going to get bigger. So Kim, walk us through this, because there's some noteworthy investors that are also involved. This isn't just the NBA doing this on its own.
Yeah, it's called the Basketball Africa League. That's 12 teams from 12 countries this year. They played games in three different places, one in Dakar, Senegal, one set in Cairo, Egypt, and another in Kigali, Rwanda. Now, there's a bunch of backing here. We have Dikembe Mutombo, all these former players, Luol Deng, Grant Hill, Junior Bridgman, Joakim Noah. And the biggest one is former United States President Barack Obama.
There it is.
Oh, whoa. Yeah.
I had no idea that he was an investor.
Yeah, he's a minority owner in the NBA Africa, which is the NBA's overall operations on the continent.
Kim, let me jump in here and say, this is surprising. Like, I read your story and I thought, wow, this is a recent initiative. Why has this not happened in the past? There have been African idols in the game, right? Think about Hakeem Olajuwon in the 80s. Why is this just now gaining momentum, this initiative?
Yeah, the NBA opened its first office in Africa, in Johannesburg, back in 2010. And that was a long time coming. When you go back historically, this really started, it had its roots in the 70s when the U.S. Department of State sent over a couple Bucks players, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Oscar Robertson, to be like American cultural diplomats in Africa. And then in the 80s, two huge stars came out of Africa. It was Hakeem Olajuwon and Dikembe Mutombo. And it was fascinating to me how not seriously these people were taken. Like, when Hakeem came over on an invite from the University of Houston, they didn't send a car to pick him up at the airport. They were just like, yeah, just get over here, we'll see, like, someone recommended you, like. And then he got out of the car, he's 7'1", and they said, oh man, yeah, please come in here and shoot around with us and see how you do.
So who are the sort of the architects of this? We talked about the money, but who are the big proponents of how the BAL is shaping up?
This guy named Amadou Gallo Fall is the president of the BAL. He was born in Senegal, and then when he was a kid, he was recommended by someone while playing in Tunisia and ended up playing Division II basketball in D.C. So he was never a pro prospect, but he stayed in the sport. He became a scout for the Mavericks and eventually ended up working for the NBA when they opened in Africa, in Johannesburg. And since then, he's been doing all kinds of deal-making with all these African governments to build courts and start schools and training programs.
Hey, Kim, what's at stake here for the NBA? If we think about the recent history of the NBA and its efforts in China, they were looked at as really huge until just a couple of years ago when we saw that Daryl Morey from the Houston Rockets, he voiced support for those pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong, and that really set the league back there.
Yeah, it set them back at least 3 years, right? So that happened 3 years ago, and things are just coming back around. They didn't air the finals on Chinese state TV last year, but it looks like we're starting to settle back into it in China. What's at stake in Africa is a billion viewers. There is a billion potential viewers in Africa for the NBA. They want to open stores there. They're going to start in South Africa, but you can't get people to buy stuff unless they care about basketball. And that's where this league comes in. It needs to be both something that people want to watch on television, but also a place to develop new talent that can then be ushered into other leagues like the NBA.
You know, I'm fascinated by the idea of recruitment, right? Because tomorrow night, Warriors, 28th pick. And 28th pick's interesting, right? Because sometimes they don't play over the course of history. I think the Warriors have had four in recent history, but the last 2018 pick, who's real, real good, Jordan Poole, 2019. Poole party. And with that in mind, gentlemen, I open up the floor to, do we actually see this as a pipeline, as a route from an African league to the NBA?
I also appreciated your very poetic description of the win and parade out there in San Francisco after your Warriors won. Yeah, there's certainly potential for a pipeline here. You've seen so many players come from Africa, but they didn't have this like institutionalized kind of path to get there. So you would either just travel here on your own, go to an American high school, play there, and then hopefully you get into college, or you go to the G League, that's the minor league in the NBA. That was all possible, but it took those big leaps in order to get there.
How good was you watched a lot of BAL basketball for this story.
A lot of
BAL how good is it? Is it is it G League? Is it NCAA finals? Is it NBA? What how good?
Well, it's not the NBA, but it's quite good. It's G League or better. It's around there.
Okay.
This is a great piece. It's by Kim Bassine and Katrina Hoje from Bloomberg Businessweek. Kim is a reporter for Bloomberg News. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Joel Weber is the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, also joining us from the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Check out Kim's story, NBA Turns to Africa to Fuel Basketball's Next Era of Growth. It's in the upcoming issue of Businessweek magazine, but you can read it now on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com. You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
The funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, well, time flies when you're having fun. And look at that. We are less than 10 minutes away from the close of trading here when it comes to U.S. equity
we
markets.
You are having fun.
You are having fun, Ed. I hope you are. Yeah, this is a fun program. We have a good time here at Bloomberg Businessweek Radio. Hey, really eager to chat with our next guest, Sameer Samana, Senior Global Market Strategist at Wells Fargo Investment Institute. Sameer joining us on the phone from St. Louis. Sameer, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing really well, thanks. I wanted to get your thoughts. I want to start with Jay Powell and the comments that we heard from him earlier today. Did anything change about how you're thinking about a 75 basis point increase at each of the next two policy meetings?
No, not really. I mean, it sounds like that's kind of the new 25, right? I mean, it was, 54 was the new 25 for a while. Now it sounds like 75 is the new 25. And, honestly, a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you've got commodity markets and inflation just not playing nice in the sandbox with what the Fed's trying to do. I mean, we just had oil not that long ago back in the 120s. And, on a month-over-month basis, you had the possibility of, CPI accelerating once again. Now, today we're down to 105, so, some of the pressure is coming off the boil. But unless that continues, you're in a situation where the Fed's trying to get that number down to 2 and you're sitting in the sixes.
Sameer, good afternoon from San Francisco. It's Ed Ludlow here. You followed the data, right? And you said current data trends suggest a mild recession by late 2022. Does anything that Fed Chair Powell said assuage that fear or change that course?
Nothing Powell said changed that course, but we were kind of out of consensus when we first made that call a few weeks back, and now, unfortunately, I would say the outlook has gotten even cloudier, maybe even a little bit less rosy. So we're on the lookout to see if that shorter, milder recession has the possibility of becoming something even a little bit longer or deeper, and that's the risk with the Fed having kind of picked up the pace from 25 to 50 and now to 75 is by the time these rate hikes actually have their impact felt, it's going to be 6 months from now. It might be the early part of 2023, and at that point, even if they were to pivot, again, you've got the same lag on the flip side.
Sameer, to Ed's question, what are equity markets pricing in when it comes to recessionary fears? Like, if you do think that there is indeed going to be a mild recession by late 2022. Is that what the equity market is telling us too, or is there further room to go down?
They probably are in the ballpark of a mild recession. I think the tricky part for equity markets is they rarely kind of stop at fair value. So they're probably in the ballpark of fair value for a mild short recession. But, as with almost all market cycles, especially when the Fed pulls the punch bowl away, you've got quantitative tightening where you've got maturities happening twice a month. Mm. You've got the next one coming up on June 30th. So I think that's the tricky part is, all right, if you're close to fair value, that doesn't give you a heck of a lot of upside from here into a mild recession, at least until recovery becomes a little bit clearer. So the question for a lot of risk takers in the near term becomes, kind of what's my upside? What's my reason for holding on to risk as opposed to, discretion being the better part of valor, moving to the sidelines and then coming back sometime in the fall when I've got better clarity around the Fed's trajectory and the economic trajectory. And I think that's what you're seeing right now is in the near term, there's the risk of that type of overreaction to, look, it's just not worth it holding on, for the next few months.
Well, let's talk about risk and opportunities, Sameer. I'm looking at the major indices, S&P 500, NASDAQ 100, both flat essentially, but swinging between gains and losses. And you learn the lesson, right, that you don't focus on a single intraday move. But where are the opportunities? What do you favor, particularly in the equities market, when you consider the factors you've outlined for us?
So I think right now you try and focus on wealth preservation and participation. And, you know, the wealth preservation piece of it, you know, we have pulled back our equity exposure, you know, for much of this year. We pulled back on higher beta, more cyclical areas like small caps, emerging market equities. On the sector side, we've downgraded financials, industrials, discretionary, comp services, and we've kind of repositioned within larger and mid caps. We put some money back into fixed income. We actually lengthened duration recently. We've also, you know, tried to get a little bit more defensive on the sector side, you know, upgrading both utilities and staples recently. And then, you know, so what that means is, you know, it's not like we've crowded into bonds. We've gotten to a much more neutral position. And I think that gives us optionality heading into the second part of this year with respect to, all right, we're not too defensive so that if the market were to have a sharp snapback, we get caught on the wrong side of it. Or, you know, vice versa, if there is a liquidity event, you know, we're in a pretty good spot where we've got some excess liquidity via fixed income to be able to kind of redeploy it.
I'm wondering about your range here, because according to the great notes that you got, our producer, Paul Brennan, you expect the S&P 500 down approximately 10% this year. You've got a 2022 SPS price target, midpoint range of 4,300, 4,600 by the year end. And here we are at almost halfway in, and we've got we're down 21% on the S&P 500, Samir.
Yeah, so, you know, to that range that we've got, you know, it's a little over 10%. It would be kind of in those low to mid-teens, which is still doable. I mean, we were, you know, at 4,150 literally weeks ago, so we were, you know, almost knocking on the door of the lower end of the range. So I think if we, you know, if the markets continue to kind of, you know, price for a milder recession, if the economy continues to cooperate, if the Fed can get inflation under control, which, you know, at least right now we're getting some relief from commodity prices, you know, that number is very much doable. That being said, I would say the risk to earnings and the risk to that target probably is a little bit to the downside, and a lot of that can kind of be, you know, steered back to, you know, these 75, you know, base point hikes. I mean, that's, you know, you're just throwing a lot at markets over a very short period of time. So, you know, if we can somehow get inflation to calm down between now and the next meeting, I know Evans was out today talking about, you know, it's possible that if the data evolves in the right way, 50 could be on the table for the next meeting. But the 75 base point hikes, I mean, those are just a very accelerated path. Now, again, you know, that may end up being the base case, but I think that's what concerns us, and that's why the risks are probably tilted to the downside.
Right, so maybe we've got about a minute left. So very quickly, what about the things the Fed can't control out there, supply side, supply chain, the war in Ukraine? How do you assess those risks?
You know, they're probably at their peak with respect to being market drivers. I mean, it's hard to imagine a lot of those things getting worse from here. So the hope is, you know, markets often work on reality versus expectations. So if the reality is just a little bit better in the second half, that could be another path towards the Fed possibly being able to ease up and us making us back to that target range.
All right. Samir Samana, Senior Global Market Strategist at Wells Fargo Investment Institute, joining us on the phone from St. Louis. Really appreciate you taking the time, Samir.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.